Podcasting. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in again to the BAMF Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty, and today we are here with legendary comics writer. Can you hear me?
I can indeed. Hello. You're having some wonderful acoustic effects on our link at the moment. Every now and then you slow down to a wonderful sort of deep exorcist type voice, which is quite scary sitting here.
Scares my 3-year-old terribly. All right, well, hey, I will let other people do most of the talking. With us today, we also have frequent podcast guest Christopher McLaughlin from Green Ronin. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm great. I'm supposed to be at work now, so this is a double thrill for me.
Adventures game for Green Ronin back in the day, so he's a diehard. We're going to talk to Dan about Rebirth. Is a very interesting. We've got Walt Rebilliard, frequent co-host as well. Hey, Walt.
Oh.
And we also have, also in the UK, Aid Smith. How you doing, Aid?
Oh, I'm good, thank you.
All right. So, Chris, I'm guessing you have some questions you want to get, you know, right off the top.
Well, yeah, and a comment. Today is the 25th anniversary of me meeting my wife, and she wanted me to send along extra special thanks to Mr. Abnett because my wife my wife was given the birth name of Tanith, T-A-N-I-T-H, and thanks to his successful series of Games Workshop novels about the planet Tanith, she now has to work a lot less hard to explain to people what her name is, how you spell it, and where it comes from. So my wife has always been a fan of yours for making her life, at least amongst the game community, that much easier. So, and plus the books are pretty awesome too. So thank you very much for that, sir.
My pleasure. My work here is clearly done.
Oh, okay. Well, listen, and I also want to extend my comments to you, the work that you're doing on Earth 2 Society, because I have been a fan of the Justice Society as long as I could read, and those are the characters that I just keep coming back to. And I've read your first three issues on that title, and I'm already hooked. I don't mean to disrespect the work of other writers, but it's a title that just kind of felt lost to me for a long time. But now I feel like this title is heading somewhere and heading somewhere good. And I really, really love the work that you're doing on that.
Well, I appreciate that comment. Thank you very much indeed. I'm really enjoying writing Earth 2. It's like you, I have an enormous fondness for that era of the DC heroes and continuity, and also the very distinctive different take on certain heroes. It's got its very flavor, different versions of heroes and that kind of stuff. And again, like you, I don't want to disrespect the work of any other creatives, but the book was in need of rescuing, which is why I was asked to do it. I don't think they saw me particularly as some kind of emergency miracle worker, but I was asked to see if I could do something with it, turn it around and straighten it up, and that's what I've been trying to do. So if the results are obvious after three issues, then I'm incredibly pleased.
Yes, I mean, it needed something other than another Dark Side invasion. After like five of them.
On my opening pitch, when they gave it to me and they said, what are the things you want to do? And the very first line was, absolutely no more apocalypse or world. Full stop. Or by, I think, another full stop, because that was just. They have actually done some terrific stories there, and I think the overall destruction of the original Earth 2 was an incredibly powerful piece of work. But there comes a point where you can't get any bigger or louder. It's in the word, the immortal words of Spinal Tap. It doesn't go up to 11, and I wanted to keep the drama. I wanted to build the characters. I want to show their interaction. I mean, clearly, I'm doing stories that are sort of global in terms of their scope. They're big, important things to happen, but it's I just didn't want to do that whole kind of, oh gosh, the whole world's going to die again at the hands of apocalypse. And I wanted to give the characters time to breathe and for some of those beats to land and for some of those interactions to develop. And also to explore the idea, which I thought was a great one, that Earth 2 Society began with, that was sort of, to me, slightly lost in the rush, which is the whole idea of an SF story about colonizing a completely virgin world, but with heroes as your main characters, which is interesting and new and different. And I've tried to play with that a lot. I think you'll see that in that opening arc, which runs through till issue 12. There are some quite sort of big sort of SF themes played against the characters of that main core of people, some of whom I felt had also been a bit neglected in the rush of things.
Wow. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to that. And okay, I was told I have to ask a question, so I understand if you can't answer it, but it's okay. Something that I think a lot of Justice Society fans are wondering about. We've been told that the JSA, at least from the photo teasers, something more like the classic 40s through 90s JSA is coming back in some shape or form as part of Rebirth. Now, are you going to be writing that, or is this going to be a separate thing from what you're doing, or is there anything that you could tell us about that possibly?
There are many things that I'd love to tell you about it. Unfortunately, Dan DiDio is standing behind me with a large gun. I have to say, there's an awful lot of really cool things happening in Rebirth. Obviously, I've been privy to a lot of it because I had to consult on the books that I'm writing. I also have had the genuine pleasure of spending time on the phone and in person with Geoff Johns talking about the overall structure of the story and the big surprises and plans. And it's not just a story, it's a whole direction and everything. And I am, as a comics fan, incredibly excited by it. As a comics writer, I'm incredibly excited to be part of it. And as a professional, I'm not allowed to say anything about it because those surprises are there for a reason. They're going to be great when you discover them. So all I can say is be excited. But I can't go into any greater detail than that, I'm afraid.
Well, you've certainly earned credit and trust with me, sir. So I'm in for the ride, and I'm confident we're headed to a good place there. I'm looking forward to see where we wind up.
Great.
Okay. Now, do I get a second question, or are we taking turns? I could go either way.
Go for it.
Okay. Well, let's see. If nobody else has an Earth 2 question,
go for it. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, sir, maybe a slightly more philosophical, broad term question.
Okay.
Yeah. I really, really enjoyed Legion Lost.
Yep.
And I was reading an essay by a good friend of mine, Justin Moreb, I'll plug him because he wrote a great essay about it, about where the concept of the Legion of Superheroes fits into things in 2016 comics in the current DC. And while there isn't, I haven't heard anything specific about a Rebirth Legion project, I'm just curious, as a guy who's written the Legion, written them well, and come up with a different take on them, what do you think the Legion of Superheroes needs to be successful in 2016?
Published. My relationship with the Legion is a strange one. In fact, I found myself saying something similar the other day in a different interview. So I apologize for the overlap that will inevitably happen. But I grew up reading Marvel. And I grew up reading Marvel because growing up in the UK, I had no access to DC comics. I knew who Batman and Superman was, but I didn't grow up with that childhood familiarity. I only discovered it, I guess, in my teens when I became a really dedicated reader of American comics. But the Marvel stuff I read was in British reprints. The American comics came along later, and I sort of devoured DC. But as a professional, starting out at the beginning of my career working for America, working for Marvel was an enormous pleasure, but also fairly straightforward because I knew the continuity. That may explain, for instance, why I got the hang of the cosmic stuff, the Guardians characters, Guardians of the Galaxy characters, so quickly, because they were all characters that I'd been familiar with for years and years and years and years, sort of forgotten neglected characters that I could put together in that book. DC, I understood the basic principles and I understood the spirit and intent, but I wasn't familiar with any of the continuity. So when Legion came along, and again, that was, I have to say, like Earth 2, a bit of a rescue operation in as much as the editor decided it was time for somebody to come in and not fix it because it was broken, but just try something different because it had become very much the same over a period of time. And don't get me wrong, there are periods of Legion history that I am incredibly fond of. Everyone's got their favorite stuff. Paul Levitz's material, I think, is brilliant. And my favorite bit, I have to say, is the notorious 5 years later Giffen run, which I just adore.
I would be shaking your hand across the ocean now if I could. I sometimes feel like the only Giffen beer bound fan on the planet. So
no, there are many of us, but we remain hidden for our own safety. I really like the Legion. Given that chance, and it was a daunting prospect because there was so much to learn. My learning curve was so steep. Not only so much history and so much continuity, but also so many characters. I mean, that's the whole point of the Legion. It's a large, large book. And I found right the sort of 5 years or so I spent writing Legion, I was intrigued by the fact that Legion has possibly the most dedicated and specific fan base of any comic title I've ever come across before. In fact, the only one that comes close to it is actually Earth 2 and the sort of that era span. Very, very specific needs, very, very specific ideas about what it should be like. Mm-hmm. And although the Legion fans at the time were not unfriendly and they were very, very sort of welcoming and everything like that, I could tell there was a sort of wariness as, you know, who the hell is this guy? What's he doing to the Legion? Why is he doing this? And so I, you know, put my heart and soul into those stories. I was very proud of the Legion Lost, the Legion World stuff, and even the reboot Legion title. And I was able to do pretty much everything I wanted to do with the Legion, except the one thing that I wanted to do and the one thing the fans wanted me to do, which was to go back to the originals, was to ignore the reboot. And that was the one thing that DC absolutely forbade because it didn't fit into continuity. So I felt I was constantly disappointing them. And when the run came to an end, I walked away from it thinking, that I've done that. That was great. I enjoyed that. And I would never go back to that because I've done it. I want to look at other things. And actually, of all the things I've ever worked on in my career, Legion has had the sort of longest term callback by fans. The people at the time who were just nice about it, since I finished writing Legion, and increasingly over the last few years, the number of times at a conventions, for instance, that I find people who go, "I loved your run on Legion. I wish you could do more." You know, and just being incredibly appreciative of it. So I guess more appreciative in hindsight as to what they had at the time because it has passed on. And I welcome that and I value that enormously. So I honestly think that the basics of Legion are incredibly strong. It wouldn't take any kind of genius to work out how to do them in a way that was true to their past and their flavor, but was seated neatly in the modern DC universe. And all the components are there. Great characters, great ideas, sort of DC cosmic at its finest. So my very, very sort of sarcastic remark about publish it, I think isn't far from the mark. I think if you bring it back, I think there is a way of making it accessible to a modern audience in the same way that Earth 2 is accessible to a modern audience. And it could be great fun. And I guess most recently, and this is not me either touting for work or speaking to get anything, but if I was asked to do more Legion now, I would probably say yes, because my fondness for it has grown enormously. I'm sort of really proud of that run. But yeah, it's a shame. I just think it's one of the reasons, sorry, I'm rambling now. One of the reasons that I did Legion Lost the way I did was simply because Legion is quite unwieldy because it's got so many characters. Oh, and yes. There's so much to learn. There's so much to express and explore so that you understand the basics of what's going on in the universe and the world of the characters are. To take a small core group of them, to deliberately whittle it down to the size of a large superhero team and place them in an unknown environment where they're learning too, seemed to be the quickest and easiest way of making it accessible to all readers. Because you could learn who the characters were quickly because there weren't too many of them, and you could learn with them what they were exploring. It was a very sort of deliberate attempt to temporarily streamline the Legion so that people got the hang of that, and then you could go on to build on that, introduce greater characters when they returned, do the Legion World series that explained the universe they were returning to. But I guess maybe that's kind of the way into it. There's a very difficult line, I think, that both... It's difficult to express this. Earth 2 and Legion, I think, both require to maintain the flavor of the past, a certain, how can I put it? I guess almost dated charm. It needs to catch the flavor of the era to have that resonance, but not too much. Not too much so that it becomes parody, and not too much so that it becomes completely off-putting to modern readers who have no idea of the nostalgia. It's a bit like Doctor Who.
Yes, yes.
It is very much like Doctor Who. I grew up watching Doctor Who from a very early age. My first live experiences of Doctor Who was as a young kid watching John Pertwee, the third Doctor. And I am incredibly fond of all the old Doctor Who's. I went back and watched Troughton and Hartnell on video, as it was at the time, and then but watched live as they were broadcast all of John Pertwee, all of Tom Baker, all of Peter Davison, some of Colin Baker, and that's and then watched and was aware of the right up to Sylvester McCoy, because by that stage I was working in Marvel UK and we were publishing Doctor Who monthly, and I was writing stories for Doctor Sylvester McCoy's Doctor. I am incredibly fond of that period. Sometimes I go back and watch them. I have many of them on DVD. When I watch them, I am lost in nostalgia and admiration for those programs. But sometimes I go, gosh, this is a bit crap. there are some really, really ropey episodes of stories. Yes. There's all sorts of things going on. And I think to myself, gosh, I could go around evangelizing saying, oh, Doctor, you've got to watch Doctor Who, it's fantastic, and the new stuff is brilliant, but you've got to go and back watch the old classic stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I watch it and go, I wouldn't show this to people. but I absolutely understand why it's great, and Doctor Who fans everywhere understand why it's great. But to mm-hmm. people who've only seen New Who, which is... Mm-hmm. its own way, completely brilliant, and was sort of redefined for modern television and modern audiences, it mm-hmm. will be a very, very hard sell, I think. You can get them excited and then show them something, and they would go, what the hell am I watching? And I think the same is sort of true of Legion, is that mm-hmm. what made Legion brilliant for fans of the 90s or 80s or 70s or 60s mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily translate brilliantly to a modern audience if you simply replicate it. You've got to find a way of capturing some of that essence in the same way that Modern Who has done, but also rejuvenating it and making it sort of relevant, and that may be a difference in pacing, in terms of language and tone. I don't know what it is, but it's something that I've looked at. And it's something that comic writers, I think, do all the time, because so many of the characters we work on Marvel or DC have been around for decades and decades and decades. Yes. It's kind of what I did with Guardians, let's face it. And certainly the Guardians 3000, the 1960 originals, updating them, I tried to preserve their spirit, but place them in a context where it felt like a contemporary comic and not some kind of throwback, nostalgic, vintage, retro thing. So there is a challenge involved, but it's not, I would have said, impossible. And I'd love to see them back. And I'd love to see someone, I don't know, someone like... I know he's done it before, but I'd love to see Mark Waid do it. I'd love to see Peter David do it. I'd love to see Jeff Johns do it. I mean, I think those are people who could do superb jobs of it. Jeff, with his just deep, deep appreciation and love of Legion, would be a perfect choice. But certainly somebody like Mark or Peter, who can handle characters, character interaction, and that kind of scope and scale of stuff. I mean, that would be a fabulous thing to see. See, I'm touting for them to work now.
You know, just as an aside, I got sent a YouTube link once where somebody had taken a John Pertwee episode and edited it in the modern style with like contemporary music, and it was one of the most disconcerting things I've ever seen in its way. It's kind of like a favorite uncle that you haven't seen for a while suddenly shows up with a beard. It shouldn't bother you as much as it does, but it's just so unexpected.
It is deeply bothering. I think one of the great things about the old Doctor Who, I think the one thing that they lost, which was regrettable, is the fact that the stories lasted for sort of four or five or six or eight episodes. And the modern stories compress so much into the 45-minute slot, rarely a two-part. And therefore, everything is so breakneck. However, when you go back and look at even classic longer stories from the old period of Doctor Who, you'll often find there's at least one or two episodes which kind of just involves running around. they got six episodes to fill, and they booked this tar pit, and so they might as well film in it for an extra day.
Yeah, the War Games being 10 episodes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, that's...
I was thinking of the endless chase in Planet of the Spiders, actually.
Planet of the Spiders, yes.
I really appreciate your thoughts about the Legion, because it's I really agree with what you're saying about how it really is a tricky balance to pull off, because we first got in this online debate after a certain film that will remain nameless came out, and when somebody first started bringing up the idea of like modern DC doing Legion of Superheroes, the first thing that popped in my mind was, do you bleed, Matter Eater lad? Yes. I was just terrified that was what we would get. So yeah. So
okay.
It is a thing that applies to all DC. These particularly DC, because it's lasted longer. I mean, Marvel has a long and illustrious heritage. You know, some of their characters you know, in their original forms, bear little resemblance to the way they do now. But DC, even more so. And it's something I'm encountering on a daily basis, particularly with things like Titans and Aquaman to a certain extent, is how do you preserve that legacy, but keep it going in a way that people aren't going to go, either you're telling the same stories all over and over and over and over again, or isn't this a bit dated and clunky and a little bit silly? And I think that's the balance you've got to strike all the time.
Okay, so here's a question for you. As you are currently writing Earth 2 at the moment, was it was kind of at the end of the Legion run for New 52, there was kind of an assumption that Legion was the future of Earth 2 rather than the future of Earth Prime. Do you know if that's the case at all, or is this just some weird internet theory that showed up?
Well, to become Grant Morrison for a moment, in the multiverse, as I understand it, at a certain point, roughly around Convergence, that was the truth. Whether it remains the truth now, I have no idea.
Oh, of course, yeah, we've had galactic cataclysm since then, haven't we? So.
Well, yeah, another one. I think there's another one due any minute, isn't there?
No, it's like buses, isn't it? Yeah.
Heaven help us if two come along at once.
Hey, Dad, can I ask you maybe a slightly heretical question? And if you don't want to answer it, that's okay. I was keeping up with Aquaman back when Geoff Johns was writing it during the New 52 days, which I guess is 3 or 4 years back now. Is your book a reboot or a continuation of what he was doing or something different altogether?
I think of all, possibly of all the New 52 books, Geoff's Aquaman was the most triumphantly successful. I think he got the tone right. I think he executed it brilliantly. It's an incredibly good read. I don't think with the rebirth there is a sense that any of the DC characters are in any way broken, but some of them are being reworked, and I can speak from my own experience with Titans, actually. They're being reworked in ways to try and make them function even more excitingly for the readership. Aquaman isn't broken. I took over Aquaman on issue 49, so I get to write the last four issues of the run that Geoff began before then doing Rebirth and coming back. So I've actually sort of already started. And as far as I'm concerned, it is a matter of maintaining that. So in fact, story threads or setups and ideas that are appearing in those last four issues are part of the bedrock of what will continue. New readers will find it accessible because, you know, we do start again in terms of introducing things, but it's not a reboot. There's nothing wrong with Aquaman. What Geoff had created, that kind of blend of superheroics with SF and horror, is set in a very real world, favoring Aquaman's experiences on dry land, where he is actually most interesting, interacting with people who, you know, don't quite get who he is. I think we're incredibly entertaining and very, very successful, and that's certainly something that I'm pursuing. So no, it's not going to be tossing away all that continuity and starting over. It's in fact, if you want to read my run on Aquaman, start now. Go and get 49.50, the double length issue. See the sort of things that are going on there, because they're going to be built on.
Now, when you're writing a character like Aquaman, who's always had sort of like a dichotomy of how he's perceived in the ocean versus how he's perceived on land, do you have like a certain process that you go through for writing a character like that? As far as you know, being of two worlds.
Yeah. I mean, that is the absolute crux of who Aquaman is, and the fact that he is part of two worlds but belongs to neither, and is sort of at the very least feared or suspected by both of them, and the ocean hates the dry land, and the dry land hates the fears of the ocean, all that kind of stuff. That sort of divided life where he stands in the middle of that, I think is crucial to who he is as a superhero. And also beyond that, there is the what might be seen as the public perception, and that I don't mean within the DC universe, I mean in terms of the readership and the world that we live in. Aquaman is often, so often, perceived as the joke DC superhero. He's not a serious hero like Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman, because he's the fish guy, and you know that he's, you know, it's become part of our pop culture life, as perpetuated by things like Big Bang Theory, that Aquaman is the silly one, and he really isn't. But I think allowing him in the comic as a character to be aware of that perception, which is something that Geoff started and I intend to continue, I think is really useful, because it's that. I think readers respond more strongly to characters in books when those characters are kind of aware of their own status. I certainly found that on Nova. One of the things writing Nova for Marvel before, back in the start of Annihilation, was that Nova was this sort of second or third rate hero who was not one of the big hitters. And I wanted him to be a big hitter because obviously I was writing a comic about him. I wanted him to be important. So to allow him to feel inferior to the likes of the Avengers, but to be granted great powers and to have him come back, I think it was during the original Civil War, and to have people go, gosh, who are you? You're quite a serious player now, meant that the book itself reflected Nova's status both within the Marvel Universe and within the readership. And I think the same thing works, a similar thing certainly, works very, very well for Aquaman.
Hey, you know, Dan, I'm going to ask a question that you can't answer, and I apologize, but I really loved your run on Nova. It's probably my favorite cosmic storyline. What's happening to Richard Rider? Are we going to see him again, or can you say there's something? Go ahead.
You are right. I absolutely can't answer that. When it became apparent that the book was going to end, I deliberately set out to do the storyline, the Thanos Imperative, which gave him, at the very least, a sort of Butch and Sundance ending with a question mark over it as to where he was. What Marvel's plans for him are, I have no idea, but I imagine they're probably quite strongly influenced by the Marvel Cinematic Universe as well. Because obviously that plays such an important part in things at the moment. And Guardians was such a magnificent film, and really more than any of the other Marvel movies, transitioned characters that non-comic readers had never heard of into the kind of public domain. So I think that for Guardians and Nova and the cosmic elements like that will have a greater bearing on what comics are produced in that reign now, because just simply because they will want to appeal to that broader audience. And that is just me making shit up, because I haven't been told that by Marvel. That's just me using my common sense.
The views
of the author do not express those of the company. That's what I'm saying.
So what actually happened to Nova? Was he stuck in the Cancerverse with Quasar?
He was stuck in the Cancerverse with Star-Lord, who miraculously...
Oh,
yeah, him and Star-Lord went out in a blaze of glory, and it was like, oh, they'll never come back, but they've given their lives to save the universe, end of my run. And then I think the technical term is magically bendiced back into the universe. I say that with great respect because Brian's fantastic. I love his dialogue. I love what he does with stories, and he obviously brought Star-Lord back magnificently, and of course had to because of Guardians. But Nova was possibly an easier character to resuscitate as a different person. And so I don't know. Like I said, I do not have I'm lying. I actually do have Axel Alonso's phone number, but I'm not going to ring him up and ask him what's happening to Nova.
Because we've just had an unveil today, haven't we, that there's a new Quasar in town, and I didn't know if that was something to do with that as well. So
quite possibly.
Very cool.
It's not a meeting I was in.
Hey, just something I've been wondering. When you're writing Iron Man, I mean, I'm guessing it probably changed since before and after the advent of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. When you're writing Iron Man now, like you did in the most recent issue of Hercules, do you try to channel, you know, your inner, you know, Robert Downey Jr.?
I think that's inevitable, actually. I think the thing about the Iron Man movies is that they actually got the character really, really well. They found somebody who, I mean, Robert Downey Jr. is brilliant, and he plays it with great, great panache. But he's playing the character, I think, as most people would identify him. So yes, I guess I do. Most particularly, I think, not so much in Hercules recently, although to a certain extent, I could hear his voice saying those lines, but I wrote a prose novel, Avengers prose novel, that where I was writing his dialogue, I sort of put on my best mental Robert Downey Jr. voice and read the lines back to myself to see if it worked. I think that's unavoidable, and it's unavoidable with any of the great portrayals of these characters, I think.
Speaking of guys like Iron Man, when you work for Marvel, do you get access to any Stark tech?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I'm sitting here in my Stark underwear, which at the press of a button automatically extends into a full suit of pajamas. climbing to bed. And, I have, you know, repulsor gloves. Obviously, everybody who works at Marvel gets repulsor gloves. I mean,
of course. Yeah. This question obviously leading into you love sci-fi, and that's clearly distinct to anybody who reads your stuff. And you get to play in some wonderful universes like Warhammer 40K. Recently, the Alien/Predator universe, stuff like that. How do you deal with the tech in comics? Like, you know, you got that decaying technology from Warhammer, but then, you know, in Aliens, you got that motion tracker that feels very much like something that we might use in the military. How do you keep all that straight in your head, and how do you play it on the page?
I guess there are various techniques. I do an awful lot of research, and I do read voraciously. I couldn't write if I didn't read an awful lot, and I read a lot of nonfiction. When it comes to franchises like Alien, you mentioned that there. I'm doing that for Dark Horse at the moment. It's a big event called Life and Death, which is four issue limited series. The Predator one's just started now. There'll be an Alien one, an Alien versus Predator, and a Prometheus one, and I'm writing them all, linking them together into one enormous, humongous story. And that's just a case of going back and watching the movies and getting a feel of it and getting a flavor. I worked on the Alien Isolation game for 2 years, and one of the things they achieved brilliantly, I think, in that was to create that sort of low-tech retro feel to the future, which Alien particularly did so brilliantly. And so I really had plenty of experience of it when I was going into writing that comic. So yeah, it is a matter of that. It's a matter of looking at something and trying to capture the feel of it as I hope it will be expressed. And I suppose that's probably a little harder in prose, in novels, than it is in comics, because in comics you've got the artist there doing all the heavy lifting for you and creating the vision and creating the way it feels. But it is a matter of, to me, the greatest matter of all is authenticity. It doesn't matter how ridiculous and outlandish the gadget is that you're using, or the technology, or the spaceship, or the cosmic cube, or the infinity gauntlet, or whatever it is that you're dealing with. If you can believe in it, and you can make the characters sound like they believe in it, and the readers will therefore believe in it. And authenticity is the greatest thing. And my basic trick, and I've used this for years. It's not a trick; it's just a technique, I suppose. I've sort of refined it writing Warhammer, which, as you say, is ultra high tech, very militaristic, but also has that sort of decaying gothic grimdark quality, which is a very distinct flavor to capture. Medieval, really. One of the things that I did was to research in some detail the closest real world analogy to the thing I was going to be writing about. And once I got the hang of that and worked out the sort of way those things were talked about by the people who used them and dealt with them and that kind of stuff, to then sort of translate that sideways back into the universe, making it fit the science fiction. So as an illustration, it's an example I've given people before, but I wrote a Warhammer novel called Titanicus, which is about the giant walking war machines, the Titans. Enormous great things with crews inside them, the gigantic things. And I thought, well, I can't research those because they don't exist, and there's nothing like those in the world. But what are the closest real-world analogs to that? And that, to me, it occurred that it actually, it's submarines, it's U-boats and that kind of stuff. It's that kind of claustrophobic experience of being inside a metal box, which is under fire, all that kind of stuff. So I researched a lot of that. I researched a lot of tank warfare. And then I use that to inform the way I wrote about the Titans and their crews. And people go, that's amazing. How did you make it feel so real? Which is very flattering. But the point is, to me, it was kind of real because I was really channeling that kind of experience from watching documentaries and reading books. And indeed, over the years, talking to veterans and serving servicemen all over the world, I've been astonished by how the Warhammer books in particular are incredibly popular with the armed services in most countries. The fact that the Gaunt's Ghost and stuff gets shipped out to PXs in Iraq and people read it. I've had people bring me copies of books that they were reading under fire, that kind of stuff. And I think the greatest compliment I was ever paid at a very early Games Day in Baltimore after I published two or three novels was a guy, because Baltimore's obviously just down the road from Annapolis. A guy came up to me and he said, "I love your books. I think he was a Marine." And he said, I love your books. Really enjoyed them." He said, "Are you a veteran?" And I thought that was extraordinary. I said, no, I'm not. Why do you think so? And he said, "Because you sound like you get it. You sound like you know what you're talking about. You sound like you know what it's like to be in that kind of camaraderie and that kind of existence and everything like that." And I that to me is the greatest compliment I've ever been paid, because I haven't, but I've kind of done my homework to the best of my ability. And these days I get told superb stories and anecdotes by readers who have actually had those experiences. And I don't, rip them off word for word, but I use it to inform the sort of stories that I tell. And that is incredibly useful. So I've heard some extraordinary things.
Yeah, as a veteran myself, a couple of your books have multiple deployments under their belts. they came with me and got passed around during the barracks, because you got a lot of downtime. You got guys who would come up and they'd look at it and look at the cover and be like, "Kind of garbage is this?" And then they'd walk away needing something to read and being very hungry for anything to keep their mind off what they were doing. And then they'd come back and be like, it almost resembled a drug deal. You got any more? This was pretty good. I really enjoyed that. So
I think it may be, and it just doesn't apply just to my work, but the Warhammer books in particular, to begin with, I couldn't understand why they would remotely be appealing to people who are actually experiencing life in wartime at the war in the war zone. And I finally sort of figured out that although they felt very authentic and identifiable and had that quality to it, they were also kind of uplifting and heroic. They embodied often the best principles of soldiering, because that's the sort of thing they were. They're adventure novels, and I think that means that they somehow are perhaps more, I don't know, encouraging or supportive than reading perhaps a great biography about somebody who's been in the war. Do you know what I mean? I think that the inclusion of a small element of fantasy and optimism and aspiration was the saving grace there. But like I said, it always amazes me that the people have read these things, as you say, on tour, under fire. The greatest story I heard about it was a Canadian tank crew. Have I told you this story? I don't think I did tell you this story last time. A Canadian tank crew hull down in Afghanistan in a Leopard tank. There were four of them, and they were under fire, and they couldn't get out of the tank for 48 hours. And they just bedded down and waited for it to, be safe to move again. And the only book they had with them was one copy of one of my novels, and it belonged to the commander of the tank. And he said, "Well, I'm reading this because I'm the commander." And he started reading it, and he got about a quarter of the way through the book, and then he tore the front quarter off this book and handed it to the gunner so he could continue reading, and the gunner could start reading the first quarter. And 48 hours later, the book was in four parts and was moving around the tank so that all the crew were reading it simultaneously. And I met them at a convention in Toronto, I think it was. And they said, "Thank you so much for keeping us entertained during what was otherwise a very difficult couple of days." And they gave me the flag from that had been flying on the radio mast of the tank, which still had the dust of Afghanistan on it. And I treasure that. And that was an extraordinary story. But if I can entertain people even that much, then that's a huge, means a lot to me.
Did the book survive the battle?
Yeah, all four parts of it.
I think you may have really hit upon something there, sir, because as I was listening to your remarks, I was thinking about how the most successful commercial period that American comics ever had was during the Second World War, because American soldiers were buying them in such great quantities. And that thought that something heroic and uplifting could be so special to somebody in that circumstance, I think there's a great amount of proof for what you're saying there.
I think there is, and I think there's all sorts of odd messages. I did hear, and this I think this is only a theory, but I believe that a lot of the Second World War comics produced by DC, I presume, they often had sort of Nazis and Hitler on the cover with the heroes beating them up. But inside the soldiers they were fighting were more generic and weren't often identified as German because they wanted them to be inspirational and supportive, which is great. But they also didn't want soldiers in dire conditions reading these things and going, oh, well, if Captain America or Superman's going to come over and beat everybody up, why am I bothering? So they kept the war in the internal stories much more generic than they did on the covers that drew them in. But I think, particularly under high stress conditions, you know, sort of the most innocent message can be a terrible weight and a terrible burden if you're in a mood to receive it in the wrong way. Yeah. So it's a serious thing.
Yes. Yeah, and I'm tying it back to the Justice Society. I think it's like in Justice Society, like 7, or All-Star Comics number 7, the Justice Society splits up, literally wipes out the Axis powers by the end of the issue, and then within a couple of issues after that, they're joining the military for a war that I guess if you're really paying attention, like, wait, didn't you guys end this war 2 issues ago? Why are you guys joining up?
No, absolutely.
So as a like yourself, I grew up mostly on Marvel, and I don't really have a lot of exposure to DC. But people keep giving me stuff, and you're gonna love this, and I can never love it. With Rebirth coming up, what will that do for new fans? So you know, I'm desperate to be a DC fan because I have a lot of friends who are DC fans, and some of them even say the same thing. Oh God, I'm desperate to be a DC fan. What coming up for Rebirth and how, what kind of stories can they look forward to kind of jump on the boat and be part of the ride?
I think as far as I understand it, the first thing it is just a great jumping on point. There's a really clear, obvious place to start reading and to have these great characters introduced to you if you're not familiar with them or you're not familiar with the particular specific details of who they are and how they work. That's part of the strong remit. And that's sort of what happened back at the beginning of New 52, in some respects quite successfully. But one of the things that DC themselves admit they kind of wish they hadn't done was to cut away all the previous continuity and therefore alienate the long-term fans. So this is, I think, being as skillfully engineered as possible to admit both of those things at the same time. And certainly that was last year I was asked to write, Dan Didio asked me to write Titans Hunt and to bring back the Teen Titans, who had not appeared, that particular lineup, which is Nightwing and Donna Troy and Garth and everybody, they had not appeared as the Teen Titans in the New 52. The Teen Titans in the New 52 was something completely different. And the remit was at the time, can you do this that sort of allows for the idea that some of their lost continuity, not just the Perez Wolfman years, but actually going back to the 1960s and the brilliant Nick Cardy era, actually sort of happened by pretending that it happened in the New 52 in some sort of way that explains why nobody knows about it. So that was my remit for the comic, and that's what I've carried out, turning it into a sort of an 8-issue horror movie about people who are sort of learning about their memories they didn't know they had and why they've deliberately forgotten them and reassembling and realizing they've been friends for years. And not realizing until quite late in the run of doing that in fact they were testing the Rebirth method and that Titans was a sort of a way of experimenting to see if those two things could be balanced out, if a writer could balance both of those elements, keeping it new and fresh and inviting, but also acknowledging and accommodating part of that old continuity. And I was very pleased to have done that to the best of my abilities. And that's one of the reasons that the Titans Hunt springs directly into the Rebirth event, and we get a new Titans book out of it. And I think I'm again imagining, assuming, and based on the conversations I've had, that's sort of what's being looked at all the characters. They want to acknowledge the past, which so many people love, but keep it fresh enough to bring new people in at the same time. It's jolly tricky.
Okay, I've got one question. Well, I've got one statement about Hercules. Okay.
Okay.
You're right. Hercules issue 5, I believe. You introduced Cryptomnesia. Is that how you pronounce the guy's name?
Okay. Yeah, that'll be fine.
Yeah, just want to say, you've created a villain there that is like up there with Prince Joffrey from Game of Thrones. I just wanted to snap as soon as he appeared. Because the way he talks is a little internet speaky stuff. But literally, the first panel he started giving all his, in case you missed it, I just wanted to give him a slap. So, well done on that. I cannot wait to see how that plays out. It's going to be fantastic.
I wanted a character who was as annoying as possible.
Yes, he is fantastically annoying.
Clearly have achieved that. I wanted to create these. The idea of that Hercules story is that he's up against the uprising storm, which are new gods who have not been created in the way that the sort of the Greek or Egyptian pantheons were sort of created as representatives of certain aspects of life, but have sort of just kind of spontaneously evolved out of modern trends and modern things. And Cryptomnesia is the sort of god of technology. He's the sort of modern Mercury, but it's all tech speak, and it's and I just thought that would be his attention span would be very, very short. He would have pay a partial attention syndrome all the time, and he would just be as aggravating as hell. So I channeled that into the character, and clearly that's what's working. I'm very fond of him actually because he's such an arsehole.
Speaking of creation, first of all, I have to thank you for Resurrection Man. What a great title that remains. My question is, when that first came about, one of the things I really, really loved about it was it wasn't, I guess, technically that long ago chronologically. It's probably longer than I want to admit because I'm old. But it came out at a time when it just seemed like comics was a more wide-open medium because it was a completely new character, completely new concept. He wasn't Bat somebody. And yet, this was a book that a major publisher could put out and support, and let it find people like me who are grateful for it. And I was just wondering if you could speak to what has changed. What would it be like trying to do a book like Resurrection Man today with a major publisher?
I don't know. Resurrection Man was a really fun idea, and when it was first proposed to DC, it was as a Vertigo book. And it was originally going to be a Vertigo book because it had that kind of darkness and real world urban fantasy element to it. And at comparatively late stage, it was shifted to being a mainstream DC book simply because we all figured out that it'd be much more interesting for a character like that to exist in a world of superheroes, which you could encounter, rather than in perhaps a sort of an undisclosed parallel version of DC or Earth or whatever. And I think it worked better as a result of that. I think his interactions with DC heroes and villains were often very compelling. But he didn't have to do that every issue, which meant that he was quite often a bystander or in the background and that kind of stuff. And that's kind of why it worked. I thought it was a wise editorial decision, and I think it served the book well. When Resurrection Man, as his name suggests, returned as one of the New 52, the reverse was true, unfortunately, in as much as I was originally asked if we could do a new Resurrection Man series, and I got very excited by that and thought, brilliant, yes, fantastic, we'll do that again, because I believe it was about 15, 16 years ago, the original series. Sorry to get that date on you. At the last minute, it was announced that the New 52 was happening and that the Resurrection Man would not be a new launch into the DC Universe 1 month going up against whatever else was being published at the time, but it would be one of 52 books out of the gate at the same time and therefore would be in direct competition with the new versions of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and indeed every other of the most famous superheroes in DC's back catalogue. I knew from day one that it didn't stand a snowball's chance because no matter how good the book was and how interested people were in it, if they were going to be asked to participate in the New 52, there were other books that were sort of much more essential to read and not everyone's going to be able to buy everything. So oddly, the great editorial decisions that made the first version of it really thrive, and I'm not blaming anybody, but the just the editorial timing the choices about when it was going to be released sort of doomed the second incarnation. I wonder if that is true these days. For a book like Resurrection Man to work or stand a chance of working, it's either got to come from a slightly different angle, mm-hmm. from a publisher like, say, Image or Boom or somebody like that, so it comes in tangentially and is not part of a greater universe and has its own identity, or it has to come out in of itself when everything is settled down in the middle of a, you know, sort of regular publishing schedule, rather than being thrown into the mix at one of these now very frequent sort of turning points in Marvel and DC where everything starts again. If Resurrection Man had been a book at Marvel that had come out post Secret Wars, mm-hmm. in the last year, I don't think it would have lasted very long for exactly mm-hmm. the same reason. I know you've seen that happen in some Marvel books. There have been some terrific ones that have bitten the dust simply because by their very nature, they simply weren't as essential to read as the Marvel books that you absolutely had to read. And that's no reflection on their quality. And I think it's a shame. And I think one of the things that's happened because of the decline in the comic market and all sorts of other things that people bang on about and make them sound ancient. But because of that, there used to be a time, I think, in the 60s and 70s, possibly into the 80s, where publishers would invest time and effort into keeping comics going past the point where they were being successful, to see if they could build a readership, and often did build a readership and turned the fortunes of comics around. And some of the big names, the biggest names of characters today are ones that went through very rocky starts until mm-hmm. they found their feet and found their audience. And that just doesn't happen anymore because no one can, it's not a matter of wants to, but can invest in that way in slightly less obvious choices. That's a shame. It probably mm-hmm. explains why companies like Image are thriving, because they're the people who can do that. Mm-hmm. It's much harder for the big two, I think, and I feel very sorry for them because I know editors there would love to look at less obviously central core books and support them and develop them. But there is obviously a necessity to preserve. I mean, let's face it, both Marvel and DC, and I mean this in a positive way, not in a negative way, but they are the custodians of great characters. This is their IP. This is their intellectual property. This is the stuff that they do. They have responsibility to keep those great characters thriving and prospering, and that means they get the attention. It's as simple as that. Mm. And I guess you'll find that everywhere else. You can find that in a tiny way in, say, I don't know, Warhammer. Warhammer will publish more Space Marine books because Space Marines are core to their IP. They would like and occasionally do publish other things, but those things, if it comes to belt tightening time, those other things are the things that get lost first, inevitably, rather than damaging the core identity of what that company does and what it's famous for. That's true of anything. That would be true of, I don't know, Disney movies or Hanna-Barbera cartoons or whatever else you want to pick. It's, you know, the core things are the bits that get the most attention.
Hmm. Aren't they doing a reboot of Hanna-Barbera and a new comic book line?
I believe they are. Yes, yeah. They are.
Future yes. Quest looks staggeringly gorgeous.
It does look fun. It does look fun. I know some people who are working on it and they're having a whale of a time.
Maybe Resurrection Man could also find his way into the Young Animal lineup that they're doing with the Doom Patrol and Shade that are still in continuity but kind of slightly vertigo-ness
to them. I think it would be a perfect place for him, and that would be interesting. Again, that's not me hinting that I know anything about that. I don't. Part of me thinks, oh, gosh, I hope I don't discover tomorrow that writer X or Y is bringing back Resurrection Man and I've got nothing to do with it. But do you know what? Part of me also hopes that it is because that character is a DC character now. You know, the fact that I've written him up to now and created him, that's lovely. But you know, a good character at Marvel or DC is one that can survive transition between different creative teams and still prosper because the strength of the character is important. And sometimes it takes another writer or artist to find a new voice and a new way of doing it. That's the whole point of the way those big comic universes work. So in some respects, I'd probably be delighted if I discovered that somebody else was doing Resurrection Man. I think that would be a compliment, and I'd wish them every success.
Speaking of different creators and different books, is it your turn for Moon Knight yet? Because it seems like everyone else has had a chance.
Moon Knight's a very cool character, yeah. And I absolutely adored Warren's run, all too brief, but Warren Ellis's run on Moon Knight a couple of years back. I think that was
terrific. Yeah, that was great.
That was great. And I think it's been followed pretty well, pretty effectively. There have been some good stories there, but his stuff was particularly sharp and focused and dynamic. And of course, the skills that he brought to that with Declan, and you can now see every month in Injection, which is one of my favorite comics.
Oh, we hit a lag.
Cool. I have nothing now. Check it out. Oh, I was trying to be a smartass, Dan, but
go on.
I didn't realize you actually wrote Moon Knight back with Andy Lanning when you did Heroes for Hire.
Oh gosh, did I? Yeah, I did. Yeah. But not properly. Not properly. He was a guest star. That's not the same thing. Writing a character as a guest star is fun, but writing him as his own book and being able to create it, sort of shape the way that book works is a very different thing indeed. So yes, I did. Yes, I'd forgotten he was in there. Oh, I enjoyed that. Maybe they'll let me do it again.
I'm glad I could remind you of that. Thank you. Hey, guys, I need to wrap up and get back to my day job. Any final questions before we call it quits?
If you have one character that you could tackle coming up, who would you go for next?
Oh, goodness me. does it have to be one? If it was DC, I would love to write Wonder Woman. And I have absolutely no doubt that the Wonder Woman that's coming along with Greg Brucker in charge is going to be brilliant. But I would love to write Wonder Woman in her own book. Having written her by proxy in Earth 2 and in Titans, I'd love to write Wonder Woman. If it was Marvel, Daredevil, please. I have no idea what I could bring to Daredevil. That hasn't been done brilliantly already. But I just love Daredevil, and it would be great to do that. And if it was sort of generally. One of the remaining big franchises that no one's ever let me get my filthy hands on is Star Wars. I'd love to write Star Wars.
Oh my God! Who do I have to pray to, bribe, or intimidate?
There you go.
Okay. Well, Chris, any more questions?
No. I've thoroughly enjoyed this.
Okay. Aide, did you want to geek out about Doctor Who a little bit?
No, I can't. There's not enough Who at the moment. It's all being made. It's all coming up till Christmas, so we've got a bit of a Who gap at the moment. So
go back and watch the John Pertwee episodes.
I've got everything on DVD, so do not worry. I have it all.
Good man.
My favourites, but Carnival of Monsters and the Three Doctors.
Yep,
those are my two favourite
Inferno.
Pertwee story.
Inferno.
Oh, Inferno's good.
Yeah. Inferno's good as well. Yeah.
Okay, well, Mr. Abnett, once again, thank you so much for talking to us. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been great. I've enjoyed it very much, and I'll be happy to chat to you guys again next time you want to have a socks board off you.
Aww.
Well, that was great. Thanks. Appreciate everybody for coming out. And then we'll catch you next time.